Food industry groups want to change the sell-by and use-by dates on products in order to cut down on food waste. Today, how to know when something is really expired and how we can reduce food waste in our own kitchens. Plus, if you're trying to learn a new language, you should do it as early as possible. That's part of the reason more daycares and early childhood centers are teaching children in more than one language. And we'll continue our week-long series on summer reading. Today, we'll hear about nonfiction books with librarians from across the state.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, the benefits and challenges of setting up bilingual programs for young kids. And we'll hear more reading recommendations from librarians across the state. Today, we're focusing on nonfiction. But first, imagine going to the grocery store, buying three bags of food, and throwing one of those bags straight into the trash. One way or another, that's essentially what happens in the U.S. because the USDA says about a third of our country's food supply is wasted each year. That's on the order of 133 billion pounds of food. How does it happen? Well, grocery stores toss produce that's misshapen but otherwise completely edible. Sometimes restaurants dump leftovers at the end of the night. But there's really one huge reason here, and that's people throwing out food that's in their fridges and pantries because they don't know whether it's safe to eat. I did this morning. I always feel very guilty about the waste of everything involved, not just the labor and the packaging, the money. We're hoping to give you some clarity on when food is actually expired and hear about some other ways we can keep food out of the garbage. I'm joined on the line now by Bob Brackett, the director of the IIT Institute for Food Safety and Health, and Janine Kanegieser with the Illinois Food Scrap Coalition and the Northern Illinois Food Bank. Bob, Janine, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Well, glad to be here.
Also in studio with me here in Urbana is Brenna Ellison, a professor at the U of I's College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. She studies consumer food choices. Hi, Brenna. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Brenna, I wonder if we can start with just a basic question about how we define what food waste is. I talked a little bit about that at the beginning, but how do you think of food waste?
Right. So it's really hard. In the U.S. even, there's four different definitions depending on which government agency that you talk to. But the big thing to keep in mind is normally we say any food that was grown to be eaten by humans that ultimately was not eaten by humans would be considered food loss and waste along the supply chain.
And and so I mentioned that at the top that there are 133 billion pounds of food were thrown out. Does that number surprise you?
It does sound really big, right? We like to think that we have a very efficient food system, but across the supply chain, yeah, it is really surprising. But the fact that it's happening at households is maybe less surprising because we don't have the same incentives we do at our households, but we're not nearly as good at responding to them as a business would be that's looking at profits and losses.
And that efficiency, though, that 30% loss, that is across all, that's the whole food supply in the U.S.
Correct. But about two-thirds of that is at the household level, according to USDA estimates.
Okay. So, Bob, I think a lot of waste gets generated sometimes because people throw out food that they think is expired. And first of all, I know there's lots of different labels here. And I mean, I wonder if we should start with, Bob, the sell-by dates. Are sell-by dates that are on containers about the safety of the food?
Well, generally, no. And there's a lot of different terms that one is exposed to. It's sell-by, best-by, use-by, purchase-by, sell-by. But in some cases, in most cases, these have to do with quality. That is, these are voluntary labels, and the manufacturers want their customers to consume them when they're good, so they'll return and buy some more. And so they will put a best-if-used-by date or use-by date in some cases, although that less of that is being done, in an effort to encourage the consumer to eat before that. Does that have anything to do with safety? Generally, no. It has to do with flavor or texture or odor or something like that. And so as a result of this, and this has been a sort of a way that food does get wasted, is because people throw perfectly good food away. And so what FDA and the federal government is now encouraging is to have a standardized term called best if used by bait. And that way that the consumers know that this is quality. If there is a safety issue, well, then they sometimes will still use the term used by and put that on there, or for something like infant formula, where it actually is a nutrition issue for little babies. Or the other thing you will see sometimes is that in the stores, you'll see the sell-by date. Again, this has to do with quality, but the consumers can use this to their own advantage because they can compare the different sell-by dates and find the freshest milk. However, just because you buy the milk and it's past its sell-by date, doesn't mean that there's anything actually wrong with it.
And so I think milk is something, Bob, that I actually think is pretty easy to tell whether or not milk is bad, right? I think we all, I was horrifying our staff this morning because I was saying I just taste it. And everyone's like, don't you smell it? I said, well, I smell it and then I taste it. And sometimes it doesn't smell bad and it's still not good. But how, I mean, when we're thinking about different categories of food, when we're thinking in particular about fresh produce or things like dairy products, how would you suggest people go about knowing whether or not things are gone or if you, the date isn't really a good indication?
Well, mostly for fresh produce, you don't see dates. They're generally not labeled. Usually we'll find this on manufactured products such as canned goods or boxes or something where they can actually put the date on there. In the case of fresh produce, you have to really pretty much rely on your judgment. So as you go to the market and you see, say, an apple, if it's a little bit shriveled, you know that it's been dehydrated a little bit and been around a while, as opposed to something that is much nicer looking, firm. The smell may be what you expect. But as was said in the introduction, sometimes a lot of the food can be ugly, that is in terms of shape or what you don't expect, and be perfectly fine. And I think consumers need to start really looking at the quality in terms of nutrition and whether it is still a good food, rather than just looking at the cosmetic value of how it looks.
Jeanine, I know that with your work with the Northern Illinois Food Bank, you all work with grocery stores in your area to coordinate food donations. And are a lot of those donations food that are getting close to that sell-by date?
They are indeed. We're fortunate to work with over 400 grocery stores where the food bank or one of our partner agencies goes to pick up donated food several times a week. This has really helped us grow our food distribution, and it's saving a lot of food from going to waste.
And obviously that food is still good to eat, correct?
Absolutely. We're focused on, we're after all, and we want to make sure that what we're just is safe and wholesome. And we have 4 distribution centers where we have volunteers engaged with sorting and packing food. So often donated food needs to be worked in some way before it goes out, whether we're bulk donations from a farmer or, marking off UPC labels, depends on what we're getting.
And Jeanine, the USDA actually has guidelines for food banks, right? About how far food,
sure.
And what are those?
So guidelines from USDA and from food, you know, based on the code date, how far after that's eaten or to be distributed through our.
Jeanine, it sounds like we're losing you a lot. Let's try to get a better connection there. And Bob, I wonder if you can weigh in here in terms of what we know about the guidelines the USDA has for this.
Well, yeah, and I think this is USDA has guidelines to make sure that the quality is still suitable for sale, even though it might be getting close to the use by date. And it's important to understand again that just because it passes the best if used by date, because in some cases consumers may take that home and it may be within the date, but then it sits on the shelf for a couple weeks and all of a sudden, oh no, it's past its date, and they automatically discard it. So USDA tries to take that into consideration when they have the guidelines for further distribution of foods, food banks and kitchens and other such places. But the one thing that they do not compromise on are any safety issues. So if the product is, for instance, the can is perhaps dented, or if they in some way consider the fact that it may have been compromised or held at temperatures that would have allowed spoilage. Those are not allowed to be distributed.
And so, Janine, I wonder, it looks like we've got you back there. When you think about food banks, I wonder how you guys work around those issues, because we could probably all learn from what you're doing.
Around the issues of, I'm sorry, I missed part of the question because I was talking to your producer.
That's okay. I was just wondering what we could learn from you, what all of the consumers can learn from what you're doing at food banks about thinking about using food past, for example, that sell by date. How you guys determine that?
Sure. So we're again following guidelines that we have from a lot of times from the manufacturer themselves about the quality and safety of food. And I would say, you know, I tell my kids all the time, just because the date has passed does not mean it's unsafe to eat. So go ahead and, you know, enjoy that box of crackers that hasn't been opened, even though the date passed yesterday, and don't throw it away necessarily because it's past the sell-by date. It's, you know, again, it's everything that Bob said at the beginning of this segment around the quality versus the safety, and know that what you're getting, if you are someone who's visiting a food pantry, that has been inspected and is quality, safe food that you can pick up for your family.
Mm-hmm. That's Janine Kanigiezer. She's on the line from Geneva, where she is a development officer at Northern Illinois Food Bank. Brenna Ellison is in studio with me here, where she studies consumer food choices at the U of I. Brenna, so I wonder, we've been talking about how food banks are efficient or tried to make this very efficient. Grocery stores do the same thing. What are ways that consumers can think about reducing our own food waste?
Sure. This is a great question I get asked quite frequently lately. So the first thing, it sounds really obvious, but apparently we're not as good at it as we should be, is making a grocery list when we go shopping and looking in your pantry first to see what you have before you go out buying more. But not just making a list, I think what's more important is actually planning meals that you're buying food for, and that seems to help. In my household, we try to be realistic, and we know that sometimes we don't want to cook at night, and so we try to plan in a few meals where we go out for dinner instead, and so we try not to buy for 7 dinners each week. Some other tips I would say in general, if you're someone who buys a lot of fruits and vegetables and maybe you can't get through them all in a week, think about subbing in some frozen ones that you could keep in the freezer. Or if you can't get through things like meat, put it in the freezer before you're concerned about the quality going bad. So those would be some big tips, I guess, mm-hmm. that might help.
Bob, what about you? What other tips are there out there for consumers to be thinking about how we can do a better job of reducing our own food waste on the consumer side?
Well, I think I would agree. Having portions that are not going to be left to be sitting around for a while till they do spoil is one way to do that. One thing I would like to stress is that when one is looking at the labels, when you see labels such as keep refrigerated or refrigerate after opening, these are safety issues, and consumers should pay attention to that. But again, purchasing products in a quantity that one can eat, say, perishables in a few days rather than having a bulk and having it sit around for longer periods of time where it is going to become spoiled, and by this I mean quality. Having a plan, and I agree, the shopping list is one way to do that, really does help focus consumers on what they should be looking at.
Janine, you're also secretary of the Illinois Food Scrap Coalition. I wonder if you can tell us about some policy changes or initiative that you guys are advocating for. You guys, it sounds like it might be that organization might be about composting, but you guys are actually focused a lot on policy, correct?
We are. The Illinois Food Scrap Coalition is a group of organizations, businesses, and nonprofits that are working to promote food scrap composting primarily as a way to handle food scraps that are at risk of going to waste and getting in our landfill. And some of the ways that we've influenced policy since starting in 2013 are around where food scrap waste can be accepted. So we've got some landscape waste transfer stations that can now accept food scrap, which is wonderful because that keeps it out of our landfills and allows it to be handled in a commercial composting facility where it can be turned into high-quality soil amendments. Mm-hmm. We're also promoting some legislation right now that's passed both houses in Illinois to put together a materials management advisory committee for the state, which would some goals for our state around waste reduction, recycling, reuse, and composting. We're pretty excited about that. And working towards increasing the capacity of our composting facilities to handle food scrap, getting some route density for our haulers, and making a robust marketplace for the end use of the compost that's formed.
Right. So on the other side of this, right, so Bob, I wonder what you think we should be doing, whether at the state or the federal level. You've talked about the labeling. Is that the most important thing we can be doing to reduce creating more food ending up in landfills?
Well, I think that's one of the primary ways that the average consumer can do something about that is just to pay attention to the label and understand what those labels mean. I think at the federal level, there's probably going to be a greater need to actually educate consumers so that everybody mm-hmm. truly understands. At this point, there's still a lot of confusion. There's still multiple types of labels, and that does become confusing to consumers. So I think having USDA and FDA and actually even the manufacturers themselves having a coordinated effort to teach the consumers what this means can go a long way.
Well, I think you guys have helped us out today because we've all learned. I have learned that the sell-by date has nothing to really do with expiration or food safety, right? It's really about quality. So that's one important thing that we can all take away from this. Bob Brackett is the director of IIT's Institute for Food and Safety Health. Janine Kannegieser has been with us. She's secretary of the Illinois Food Scrap Coalition and development officer at the Northern Illinois Food Bank. And I want to thank Brenna Ellison for being with us as well. She teaches at U of College of ACES, studying consumer food choices. Brenna, Bob, Janine, thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Nyla. I appreciate the attention on this topic.
Coming up, we're going to be continuing our summer book series. Today, we're talking about nonfiction titles. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 4th of July weekend is fast approaching, and besides all of the food and fireworks and time with loved ones, hopefully you also have some time to unplug and relax, maybe read a good book. This week, we're getting recommendations from writers, from bookstore owners, and librarians all across Illinois. Yesterday, we talked about fiction. Tomorrow, we'll hear kids and YA books. Today, we're focusing on nonfiction, which is a huge category, but we've got lots of great titles to talk about this morning. To tell us some more, I'm joined by three public librarians from across Illinois. Diana Sussman is the library director for the Carbondale Public Library. Sherry Bay is the adult services librarian for the Lincoln Library in Springfield and is at our partner station, NPR Illinois. Carol Toyerns is joining us from our partner station, WGLT in Normal. She's the adult services manager for the Bloomington Public Library. Diana, Sherry, Carol, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Good morning.
And so I wonder when we think about fiction genres, you know, there's lots of different categories within fiction, right? There's sci-fi, romance, fantasy. Nonfiction feels very big. Sherry, can I start by asking, how do you decide when someone comes in, if they say they like nonfiction, where you want to steer them towards?
I basically just ask them maybe what their interests are, maybe what they're into at the moment. And I also try to find out what they've read in the past to try to narrowed down maybe some books or some areas that they'd be interested in.
And Carol, how oftentimes when people, I wonder if you've noticed people checking out audiobooks, are they more interested in checking out audiobooks that are fiction or nonfiction?
I think nonfiction is growing. Fiction may have a wider reading audience, but there's so much great nonfiction out there that it has a very large audience as well.
Mm-hmm. And Diana, I wonder how much more people are checking out audiobooks electronically. I mean, you can check out an audiobook either electronically or I imagine in person at the library in Carbondale, right?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And nonfiction actually circulates a little bit more than fiction. So that might be because it meets certain information needs, but there are certainly a lot of people who read nonfiction just because that's what they enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let's get to some of your recommendations that you have here. And by the way, those of you listening are welcome to chime in. If you've got a really a great nonfiction book that you have read, you can tweet us. Our handle is 21STShow. You can text us. Our phone number is 217-394-5765. Again, that's 217-394-5765. Diana, let's start with you. You have a book by Elizabeth Gilbert on here.
Yeah, I do. Big Magic. So the subtitle is Creative Living Beyond Fear. Elizabeth Gilbert wrote Eat, Pray, Love. And this book is so good, Big Magic, that I would love to eat it, actually. You can't get enough of it. I listened to it actually on audiobook, and it is read by the author herself. She talks about how to live creatively and take on the creative projects that you want to take on, how to tackle your fears. And she does talk a lot about writing, but she also talks about a friend who was a figure skater as a child and decided to take up figure skating again in her 40s. So it's just basically giving you permission and courage and a lot of practical information and guidance for handling everything that comes up when you decide to live creatively, including the things you don't anticipate, like that you may not succeed in getting your writing published, or that it might not be, you know, one magical moment after another. There's tedium with everything. But as she explains this stuff to you, it doesn't discourage you. It makes you feel more and more empowered to do the creative things that you want to do in life. So,
oh, wow. So, Diana, it sounds like, did it change anything about the way you are doing things? Did it make you want to be more creative?
A little bit. I mean, I am creative. So I was listening to it as an audiobook, and honestly, I got it from the library, so I had to turn it back in. But if I owned it, I would just leave it on all the time every time I'm driving my car. so she talks about a few things, like if you if you're writing books, do you quit your job after you publish your first book? And she adamantly says no, and yet says that in a way that doesn't dash your dreams but makes you feel you know, practical. She says that she didn't quit her job until her several books in. And, of course, Eat, Pray, Love was such a phenomenal success, and she didn't know that it would be. But at that point, then, she did need to quit working and just be a writer. But those are the types of things that I always wonder about, you know, when you read someone's autobiography, little, you know, their blurb on the back of their book is, how did they get there?
Right. When did they become a success or decide that they were such a success that they could just be a writer? That's a big question, right?
Yeah.
Diana, a lot of people ask that. So that's Big Magic, Creative Living Beyond Fear by Elizabeth Gilbert. Sherry, you recommended From Writing to Cooking, Notes from a Young Black Chef.
Yeah, so this is a memoir by a 2019 James Beard Award-winning chef, Kwame Onwuachi. He basically grew up with his mom, who had a small catering company from her kitchen in their small apartment in New York. And he used to help her cook Creole and Caribbean-inspired food. This book follows him on his path to becoming he is now an executive chef and owner of Kith & Kin, a Michelin star restaurant in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I just actually read this on my way back from Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago, and I really loved the story. I think a lot of memoirs, sometimes I feel like I read a lot of memoirs, and this is one of the most interesting ones I've read recently.
Yeah.
Just because he's got such a great life story. It's such an interesting story.
Really does. There's so many starts and fits throughout his journey to becoming the culinary star that he is now, just with his career choices along the way. It's just really neat to see also how so many people tried to stick him into like maybe a stereotype of soul food, and he definitely did not fall into that, and he knew what he wanted to do and he persevered, and I think that's just fascinating to read about.
Yeah, that's Notes from a Young Black Chef. By the way, we're going to have all of these titles compiled at our website at 21stshow.org. So don't worry if you don't have time to write it down now or want to go back to it. You can just go back to our website. Carol, speaking of memoirs, you recommended a memoir as well. This is called Educated. Can you tell us about this?
Yes, this is a very popular current book by Tara Westover. She grew up in a remote area in Idaho with a family that was very self-contained. They kept to themselves. They don't believe in public schools or anything to do with social services or the government. So she had a very isolated life as a child with her family and her siblings. Yet she went on to graduate from college and earned a master's degree and eventually a PhD. So the book is about her journey from that childhood into what most of us would consider a more traditional type of a lifestyle as an adult.
And I wonder, when we think about this, Carol, we think about it, I feel like there are probably a lot of books out right now about our country's cultural divides. I wonder what stood out to you about reading about Tara's life.
It's just interesting to go past that norm of having an early life where it appears to be somewhat limited and being able to go beyond that and make huge changes and get to a level that you know you're happy with and that you're successful with. It's what she did. So it's very inspiring in that sense, yet she still honors how her family lives and how they some of her family members still continue to choose to live.
It's actually, well, it's kind of a little bit similar, I think, to Notes from a Young Black Chef in terms of that inspiration and overcoming odds. Diana, you have a couple of other ones on here. I'm afraid we're probably not going to get to all of them. What else did you want to talk about on your list?
Since you mentioned cultural divides and so forth, I'll talk about The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. It's by Richard Rothstein, and it came out in 2017. The book explores issues like redlining, which you may have heard of, practices in which there were maps laid out that didn't just go to realtors, they also went to the banks. And they divided cities up by color line. And it turns out that if you crossed a color line, you could not get an FDIC-insured loan. So in my mind, the thing that's interesting is that and tragic is that I had known always that there were individual people who didn't believe in segregation, and so they would harass a family into not moving into their neighborhood. But I didn't realize that it was systemized by the federal government and by the banking system, so that in many, many cases, African American people were barred from purchasing a mortgage. And what that led to was predatory contract sales, in which you would end up in a private rent-to-own situation. And the terms of that contract would basically mean that your equity, your your deposit, all of that would be forfeited if you made a late payment, or even if you got a ticket for not mowing your lawn, for example. So it was like a rent-to-own situation in which you had everything at risk and you could easily lose all of the money that you had with one small error, one small setback. And ultimately, then that contributed to a wealth gap that we still see today between Black and white families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a great, I remember when this came out. This came out in 2017, and this is one of those, if you missed it when it came out, is a great one to read this summer, especially if you're really interested in these issues. But you're right, Diana, in terms of it really contributing to an understanding of our history and what exists today, sort of in terms of a wealth gap between Black and white families when it comes to real estate. That's The Color of Law, Forgotten History About How Our Government Segregated America by Richard Rothstein. Sherry, you have a couple to completely switch because nonfiction is a huge genre. You have a couple true crime suggestions that you made.
Yeah, I do. And actually, there's a connection between the two of them, which is kind of fascinating. So the first one is Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered. And it's by the two women who have a podcast podcast called My Favorite Murder, Georgia Hardstark and Karen Kilgariff. So on their podcast, they basically take a comedy and true crime and they mix it together. And it's a widely entertaining podcast. If you've never listened to it, it's really worth listening to because you learn something, you get to have a laugh. These two women are definitely feminists, which is always great to hear what they have to say and their take on things. And so they came together in a part dual memoir, part comedy. And they talked about both of them tackling their fears and biggest mistakes growing up and kind of reflecting on life events that shaped them into who they are today. And the connection, Karen Kilgariff was friends with Michelle McNamara, who wrote I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is the true crime masterpiece, basically, about the Golden State Killer. And so she worked for almost decades on trying to crack the code on who this murderer was. Started out as the East Area Rapist. He had several other nicknames. But she's described as being obsessed with this case, and she worked with investigators. She worked with retired investigators in law enforcement and other friends. She even went online and worked with online sleuths to try to figure out maybe some cracks that the police didn't find or investigators didn't know about. And she got so close to solving the case herself, like through her blog. Unfortunately, she passed away, I think, in 2016. And so this past, last spring in 2018, they finally did catch the killer. And
wow. So for people who love this genre, this sounds like it's a really fascinating story. So that's I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. Mm-hmm. The other title you mentioned was Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered.
Yes.
Carol, you have a book on here that I've actually really been meaning to read for a long time. That's The Library Book by Susan Orlean.
Yes, I recommend this for anybody who loves libraries and loves books and loves reading. The basic part of the book is looking at a very large fire that happened at the Los Angeles Public Library in 1986. It was very catastrophic. The book follows the storyline of that fire, but then in amongst that, she talks about the history of the Los Angeles Public Library itself and the development of public libraries in general. It's really a fascinating book. It looks into the question of who started the fire, if there was a person that started the fire, and she discusses the main suspect, although no one has ever been charged with that. And it's just, even working in libraries as I have, I felt I learned a lot about how our society, our whole country has developed and how important libraries have been there. So yes, it's really an interesting book.
That's Carol Torrens, who's joining us from our partner station, WGLT in Normal. And you're at the Bloomington Public Library. I would remiss if I didn't ask you, Carol, about what events you guys have going on this summer.
So summer reading is our big event. All ages, from infants up through senior citizens, are welcome to participate in our summer reading program and earn incentives for doing that. And then we have all sorts of programs, music, speakers, lecturers, plays. We're going to have a talent show and a lot more.
Okay. And Sherry, what about at the Lincoln Library in Springfield in terms of what you guys are planning this summer? A busy schedule?
Yeah, so same with Normal. Summer reading definitely kicked off. We have a lot of the similar things. Magicians, musicians every Wednesday in our atrium. We're going to have Disney Day here in a couple weeks as well, where some of the staff will be dressed up as Disney characters, and we'll have different stations of activities for children to do. One of the big programs for adults, we don't have as many for adults as we do children, is a do-it-yourself succulent terrarium class. And it's pre-registration, but you take a mason jar and you do the different layers of gravel, soil, moss.
Not something maybe people would think that you would do at the library, but
right.
That's at the Springfield Library. We're almost out of time, Diana, but I wanted to get to your other books on your list are about health and medicine, I imagine. Is that a topic you've been interested in lately?
Yeah, Yeah, I don't know why it just comes up. I really enjoyed the book Dead People Suck, a guide for survivors of the newly departed by Laurie Kilmartin. She's a comedian, and she's writing a book about a topic that I think just really blindsides us, and we almost all end up going through it, where our parents get sick and we have to face their mortality and eventually their death,
wow.
Their departure.
Yeah, so
and,
unfortunately we're out
really...
of time, so I'm going to have to stop you there, Diana, but that's Dead People Suck. We will have all of this up at our website at 21stshow.org. But Diana, Sherry, Carol, thank you all for taking the time to be with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Have a good time reading.
Tuning in to the 21st, I'm Nyla Boodoo. If you're trying to learn a new language, researchers say you should do it as early as possible, even as early as the first year of your life. For that reason and others, many parents are turning to bilingual daycare and early education programs for their toddlers and preschoolers. We're going to spend the rest of today's show talking about what's behind that. Luisiana Melendez joins us now from Chicago. She's the director of the bilingual program for the Erickson Institute, an education organization focusing on early childhood development. Professor Melendez was also recently named to the Chicago Board of Education. Martha Gonzalez is also joining us. She's executive director of the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul, that's just north of Champaign. They provide daycare and after-school programs for kids from 6 weeks to 12 years old. Luisiana, Martha, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
And finally, in studio with me here in Urbana is Luke Scharf. His son, Ethan, is in the bilingual immersion program at Leal School in Urbana. Hi, Luke. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you for having me.
Luke, I wonder if we can start with your family story. Why did you decide to enroll your son, Ethan, into this bilingual education program?
Well, he had some Spanish in preschool and became very interested in it. So we started getting him additional Spanish education. And then when we found out about the bilingual program, we enrolled him in that as well.
Now, are you and your wife Spanish speakers?
We are not. It's a completely English-speaking household except for Ethan. So.
And so what were the things you and your wife were thinking about when you were considering enrolling Ethan in this school?
Well, there's two things. One, it gets him an ability that we can't teach him. And the other is that it seemed like the right kind of challenge for him to at that time and continues to be. So.
And how does it work for him? So are all of his classes in Spanish or what does it look like?
When they first start in kindergarten, it's 100% Spanish. And then by fifth grade, they gradually shift to about 50-50 English and Spanish.
Okay.
So everything from the classroom direction on down is in Spanish.
Wow. So, Luisiana, I wonder, is that pretty typical when we're thinking about bilingual programs, how Luke's son went through his education, starting completely in full Spanish immersion and then gradually adding in some English as well?
It's typical of one type of bilingual education, what is called dual language immersion. But there are other models that are do not necessarily mirror that kind of language allocation. And the reason why he was fully immersed in Spanish, there's strong research that suggests that the minority language, which in this case would be Spanish, because otherwise Ethan, I believe,
yes,
is your son's name, would be, in an English-speaking society. It seems to work better when the minority language is really, children are immersed in that. In dual language programs.
And Luisiana, we're thinking about this. I mean, I was thinking about, I grew up in Miami, so as part of my public school education, I had Spanish from kindergarten, which I'm now realizing was maybe a little bit unusual. How important is it to introduce children to other languages? How early in age is the most important thing for children to be introduced?
Well, as you were pointing out in the introduction to the segment, research shows that we are wired to learn multiple languages from birth. When children are born, they can discriminate among any sound made by the human phonemic apparatus. But that ability starts to narrowing to just the languages that the child is exposed to. And by about 12 months, children become language-bound listeners. So they are only able to discriminate the sounds in those languages that they've been exposed to. Now, that does not mean that if you did not learn a second or third language during the first year, that their window is totally closed. Of course not. Children continue to develop language, whether one or two or multiple, across the first 5 years of life. And, of course, I learned English when I was an adolescent. So, and there's many people that successfully learn languages as adults.
But it's just a lot harder, it sounds like, right?
It's just a lot harder. Yes, absolutely.
So, Luke, is Ethan 9 now?
He is 9.
Yeah. And I imagine he's a fluent Spanish speaker?
He is fluent. When we go places, he will strike up a conversation with someone in Spanish. And I can't always follow it, but...
So he ends up translating for you guys maybe sometimes?
He can. We hope he will do more of that because this will... You know, he'll be able to travel comfortably anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, so we'd like to tag along.
Yeah, right. Martha Gonzalez is also with us. And Martha, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul that you work with. You have daycare and after-school programs for children 6 weeks to 12 years old. I wonder if you can just tell us, first of all, how your facility is bilingual. What do you guys need to do in order to be qualified as bilingual?
Well, we have been trying as much as we can with the resources that we have to have the program bilingual program. But it's been very struggling, as everybody knows. It's very difficult. We are almost in a rural area where it is difficult to find the appropriate qualified teachers. Regardless of that, we've been implementing and trying to talk to the children and Spanish, and we have experience. We have seen the children since 6 weeks old, all the way to 2, 3 years old, 5 years old, learning native speakers English, and also the reinforcing the Spanish of those children that come to this country, that they lose it because the parents, the communication and at the schools, and I'm talking about the after-school program, when they go to schools, they're fully bilingual, fully English, and they try to lose the Spanish and the communication.
So you're trying to help them keep their Spanish, Martha, it sounds
exactly.
Like, in their aftercare then, right?
Yes, yes. But in the with the early years, we have noticed is what the doctor, what is her name? I'm sorry.
Dr. Melendez, yes.
Dr. Melinda says it is true. We teach them and we talk to them in Spanish all the time. By 2 years old, they already understand commands in Spanish. They already know how to, they even reply to the teachers in Spanish. So it is... We help them the native speaking English that way, and also we help the Spanish speaking population to maintain the language.
Mm. So I know you have teachers that speak Spanish in every classroom at the Multicultural Community Center, and it sounds like we can probably hear the kids at your summer program in the background there.
Yes, I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. We love to hear the kids. Martha, what do you need to have, though, in order to have a bilingual program to be qualified? So even though you have teachers that speak Spanish, that's not enough to qualify as bilingual, right?
No. We've been trying to get a director qualified who has the bilingual skills, but it's almost impossible. It's almost impossible with the ISB requirements. It's almost impossible in this area. So it has to be somebody who has the early childhood education with endorsements in bilingual, and it's very, very, very difficult. So we've been trying to contract with some people for part-times and helping us with little here and there, but not fully full-time person who can dedicate to this. It's very, very hard.
That's Martha Gonzalez, who's joining us from Rantoul, as she's describing. That's a town just north of Champaign, where she's executive director of the Multicultural Community Center. Luisana Melendez is also on the line with us from Chicago, where she teaches at the Erickson Institute and was recently also named to the Chicago Board of Education. Professor Melendez, when we're thinking about, to Martha's point, do we have enough teachers that are qualified currently when we're thinking about Illinois? I imagine Chicago has a higher proportion than the rest of the state. But teachers who are qualified to teach in not just either a bilingual or an ESL capacity?
Unfortunately, we do not. And that, I think, is a big irony because we are indeed, in fact, such a multi-language country. But, you know, in order to qualify and to be certified as or endorsed by ISBE as a bilingual teacher, you have to be not only bilingual, not only have the oral skills, but also be biliterate. And we have been, as a society, I think, remiss in promoting and mining that wealth of resources that we potentially have with so many families speaking different languages at home. But that is not always encouraged or supported in schools. So that has led to a shortage of bilingual teachers across the state.
Luke, why was it important for you to have this education for your son? You said you thought it would be important for him in the future. And it's not just, as you imagine, it's not just him being able to speak Spanish, but also to be able to read and write Spanish.
That's right. You know, Champaign is a very multicultural area, or Champaign-Urbana. And so a lot of people we know are bilingual, and we didn't want him to miss out. The other thing is it really does open some doors. It allows him to travel and do business, you know, as an adult over a much bigger part of the world than I can, or that at least I can easily.
And is it strange for him this summer because now he's not being immersed in a Spanish environment or language environment? Mm-hmm. Have you tried to find other opportunities for him now that he's not in school this summer?
Yeah, I think he's been in a little bit of Spanish withdrawal because he's he was playing with some kids the other day, and he just started speaking Spanish to them, and it was actually really fun.
And I wonder what the class makeup is. Are there native mm-hmm. Spanish speakers in his class as well?
Absolutely. It's quite a spectrum of both across languages. Some kids are trilingual or even more in the classroom, but depending on where they what their background is, and quite a great group of kids.
Yeah, so when we think about that, Luisana, I wonder if you think when we're talking about particularly Spanish, is there still a stigma around maybe being able to speak Spanish or speak English? Do you feel like that might be part of a problem here?
I believe so, and there was actually a story going around in social media yesterday that a colleague sent me about Julian Castro, who's a candidate for the Democratic Party, being criticized because his Spanish is not very fluent.
Well, he's Spanglish. He speaks perfect Spanglish,
yes,
right?
Exactly, yes.
Right.
So he was saying that was the result of the stigma that often was associated with being bilingual and with speaking Spanish in particular. I think, you know, that hopefully, my hope is that will change. One of the things that the state of Illinois became a few years ago, one of the states that grants high school graduates that are bilingual the seal of biliteracy, which is a seal that goes into their high school diploma and, you know, it sort of earns graduates points on college entry and for, as Ethan's dad was saying, also for career choices. So I think that is changing, that there is a greater awareness that being bilingual is an asset, not a deficit or something that needs to be, you know, cured. But the change is slow in coming.
Martha, right? Yeah. Martha, I imagine you have a lot of Spanglish kids at the Multicultural Community Center.
I do. 90% of our students here are Spanglish, yes.
Yeah, that's what I say. I think when you grow up in Miami, I say I speak perfect Spanglish. That's what I tell people now. But I wonder, for you, though, I imagine it's important to retain Spanish, probably not just for the language, but also for cultural reasons. Do you think being multilingual is important?
Absolutely. It is very important. We promote cultural from a background. We promote a lot of activities from their own countries. We have people from Puerto Rico, Guatemala, Honduras, Mexico. So we try to promote that cultures. And also, as I said before, maintain the language, because by the age of 13, 14, 15, they are fluently in English, and they have the tendency, for several reasons, they are don't like to speak Spanish anymore, and the communication between parents and the students are extremely hard. And I've seen it many, many, many times. When they get to the age of teenager years, which are very, very difficult, they can't communicate. The message they want to try to send in one language is the other parent, it doesn't receive it in the same.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's so important when we're thinking about, even when you're speaking the same language sometimes with teenagers, it's hard to communicate. So thank you for that. Thanks for all of you for joining me to share a little bit more about this bilingual education and what's happening across Illinois. Luke, thanks for sharing your family story. Luisiana Melendez with the Erickson Institute. Martha Gonzalez with the Multicultural Community Center in Rantoul. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for having us. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, speaking of what we learn in class, fewer students are learning cursive. We're going to be talking about that. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.